This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Asad Dokroub was a Muslim musician and teacher of Arabic in the Midwest. He was part of the first wave of migration from Greater Syria to the United States in the late 1800s. Here's some very old audio of him singing. Asad Dokroub lived for a time in towns across the Midwest. Sioux Falls, South Dakota, Sioux City, Iowa, and Michigan City, Indiana, all places with communities of Muslims in the early 20th century. Our Midwestern past is far more diverse than many of us realize, particularly when it comes to religious diversity. And that is the subject of a new book called Muslims of the Heartland by Edward E. Curtis IV. Curtis is chair of liberal arts and professor of religious studies at IUPUI, the joint venture of Indiana University and Purdue University in Indianapolis, IUPUI. He grew up in southern Illinois, though, and is the descendant of Syrian Midwesterners. Edward Curtis, welcome to the 21st show. And Edward, if you're with us, I don't know if you might be muted. All right, we're going to see what's going on. I am not able to hear you, so while our engineers troubleshoot that, I'm going to mention if you want to join our conversation, if you have a question for our guest, maybe you're a Muslim person living in the Midwest or of Syrian Lebanese descent in Illinois, 800-222-9455 is the number to join our conversation. That's 800-222-9455, or you can tweet us at 21st Show, at 21st Show. I should also note that Edward Curtis is giving a talk in Springfield this Thursday evening. It'll be at 7 p.m., April 7th, in the Union Theater at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Again, that's 7 p.m. this Thursday evening at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. We're going to continue this conversation. Again, the book is called Muslims of the Heartland, How Syrian Immigrants Made a Home in the American Midwest, with Edward E. Curtis IV. If it sounds like I'm stalling for time, I am. We are trying to reconnect with him by phone to continue this conversation. Again, if you want to join our conversation, the number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455, or you can tweet us at 21st Show. That's at 21st Show. And I think we have Edward Curtis with us now. Are you there? Can you hear me?
I am.
All right. Well, I'm glad to talk with you. That is a very long introduction. So let's get right into your book, which begins with the story of your own family. And you write, "That yellow linoleum flooring kitchen in southern Illinois was the womb where my Arab identity was born and nurtured." What did you know about your family growing up?
Well, I was taught by my grandmother, my Arab grandmother, Cassie Samaha Moses Safa Kafri, that I was part of a proud people from what today are Syria and Lebanon, and people who immigrated along with millions of others from Europe and the Mediterranean before World War I and established their roots in the Midwest and across the United States.
Did you know you had Muslim roots growing up?
No, I had no idea. And you know, all I could do, the best I could do, was to speculate in the end. I began to search, and I think it's possible that members of my family were indeed Muslim, and they married other Arabic-speaking Christians who were the majority of the immigrants who came from the Ottoman Empire in the Eastern Mediterranean. But if that is the case, it was deeply hidden, and I will likely never know for sure.
Why do you think that is, that it was so hidden?
When Muslims immigrated to places with other Muslims, they in the Midwest, they established communities. They met critical mass. But, you know, if when Muslims immigrated sort of solo, and many of them were peddlers, So perhaps my Hamaway family, who were peddlers like so many other Arabic-speaking Syrian and Lebanese, they went to the Boot Hill of Missouri and to southern Illinois. And it's possible that it was they were the only Muslims in town, if they were Muslims. But I know for a fact that for those Muslims who basically get stranded in places like in the Dakotas, that they oftentimes will convert and become Lutheran like everybody else around them. And some of them, this is actually not some sort of loss, something to be mourned. It was a natural process of assimilating. In other places, Islam becomes a way to assimilate to the Midwest.
Yeah, you have a line in there in one of the chapters on the Dakotas, and we can come back to this after the break, which we need to take here in a moment, about somebody talking about how I think he did some interviews during the New Deal era about how he had helped establish the first Muslim church, and he used that phrase, church, in the area. And we can talk about that when we come back. We're speaking with Edward Curtis, who is a professor of religious studies and chair of liberal arts at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, IUPUI. And more to the point for us, he's the author of the new book, Muslims of the Heartland, How Syrian Immigrants Made a Home in the American Midwest. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation. More to come after a short break. You're listening to The 21st Show. Do stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey.
Studio Alam Fon Qaddim Al Mutriba Nurhan.
What you're hearing is music from a 20th century record label that brought music from the Arab world stateside. We're discussing the somewhat hidden history of early 20th century Muslim communities in the Midwest. We're speaking with Edward Curtis, professor of religion at IUPUI in Indianapolis and the author of Muslims in the Heartland. He grew up in southern Illinois and is the descendant of Syrian Muslims there. And the book discusses not only his own family story, but also the story of other Muslim men and women who helped form the fabric of Midwestern communities in the early 20th century, from public schools to grocery stores, dance halls, and farms. If you have a question for our guest, or maybe you are a Muslim living in the Midwest or are of Syrian Lebanese descent in Illinois, join the conversation at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Or tweet us at 21st Show, at 21ST Show. So your book is not the story of all Syrians or all Muslims in the Midwest, but of a specific group. Can you talk about that?
Most people who immigrated from Ottoman Syria, which today includes the countries of Lebanon, Jordan, Palestine, and Syria, most of them were Christian. They were Orthodox or Melkite or Maronite. And they built churches all across the Midwest, including in Chicago and Peoria. And so these folks were the majority. But in the Midwest, in some places, especially in the Dakotas, Muslims accounted for a third of all of the Syrian, Lebanese, Arabic-speaking people who immigrated. So this is a very diverse population. And one of the things that the book helps to establish is that we're sort of taught that, oh my goodness, Arabs can't get along with each other across religious lines. That was not the case in the Midwest. And one of the reasons was because, you know, if you're one of the few Arabic speakers in town and your culture is important to you, it's important to cooperate. Also for business relationships, there were deep Muslim Christian business relationships among these Arabic speakers. They helped each other get their start in America.
That's interesting you mention that because, yeah, I think that, I mean, there are different forms of Islam, Sunni, Shia, Alawite, among others. I mean, did those differences manifest in the communities here?
They did in Detroit, but everywhere else they didn't. And the reason is you just didn't have, if you wanted to establish a mosque in Ross or in Cedar Rapids, as they did, you know, you needed the support of everybody. And these sectarian identities were not as important in 1900 as they would become after 1950. So we have to be careful not to read our own contemporary concerns back into the past.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. You know, let's talk about, you mentioned establishing a religious, a mosque. There was that one person that you cited, though, who called it a church. Can you talk about his choice of language and what that says about, you know, assimilation or non-assimilation, or have at it as you will?
Yeah, so that was in Western North Dakota, and this was dominated by Scandinavians, and there were a lot of very close interactions among Scandinavian and Syrian immigrants. And what that was, he was talking to someone from North Dakota, and in order to explain what a mosque was, because the knowledge of Islam was fairly thin among Americans at the time, he translates. And so what he means is, this is our religious congregation, but, you know, he says it's a church so that other people can understand it. That's what's going on there. He's translating.
So the cover of your book, which again is Muslims of the Heartland, it has this really cool map created by, I think, Scott Schiller is the artist there.
That's right.
And there's a bunch of cities highlighted: Chicago, Cedar Rapids, Sioux Falls, also Cairo, Illinois. So what did you discover about Cairo and the Syrian Muslims there?
Right. So that's where my family is from. So I grew up with all kinds of tales of Cairo. Now, there were Muslims in Illinois around the Chicago area, and they first came in large numbers to work at the 1893 World's Fair, and they were also peddlers. But Illinois, like Central and Southern Indiana, was overwhelmingly Christian in terms of its Arab population. So, I mean, and these are household names in Illinois. The Lahoud family from Peoria, for example, they're part of a huge Christian Syrian Lebanese community, you know, in Illinois. My own family, the Samaha, who became the Moseses, and the Hamaways, and later the Safas and the Hellenes, they were all, by the time I was growing up, they were all Christians. If there were Muslims, you know, among their ranks, they were either secret about it, or they had simply, you know, over time, over the generations, Islam had fallen away as an identity with which they identified.
Well, you mentioned the Hamaways. Can you talk about your great great grandfather, if I got the orders of magnitude there correct? His gravestone is featured on that map. It's this one of the most interesting gravestones I've ever seen.
Yes, talk about it's a Woodman of the World gravestone.
It looks like a log almost. Yeah,
that's right. Well, Woodman of the World. You know, it was a burial insurance policy. It's very popular at the time. Yeah. So the Hemingways, you know, there was a one of the reasons why I began to think that maybe my own family was Muslim. I mean, there were hints. That was first that the men in on my grandmother's maternal side would never set foot in a church, and there were other sorts of sometimes the brother, I should say, of my great great grandfather, Anas Hemingway, is credited with inventing the ice cream cone at the St. Louis World's Fair in 1904. This was a story I grew up with in Southern Illinois. And he's often referred to by others as a Muslim, but it's just very hard, you know, to trace this. And what I learned as I was doing the research is that, you know, that in many ways, religious sector identity was less important than that cultural heritage that they shared, that love of that music that you just played. It didn't matter. They listened to Muslim and Christian singers, you know, and they shared their food together. And in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, when the Arab women of the church would help the Arab women of the mosque roll grape leaves for their fundraisers and vice versa.
I don't want to get too highfalutin in here, but it sounds like what you're describing is sort of the way people are othered by society, if you will, using that phrase, sort of defines how they come to see themselves in some way. Do you think that's a part of the story here?
There's no doubt. I mean, one of the things that is one is a big theme in the book, and I think it's a historical theme in history is, sometimes history happens as waves, and these waves of social, economic, and political forces wash over us, and we do our best to adjust to them. But there's th this was a small population, and they became, they were oftentimes seen as foreign. But what my book shows is, guess what? They identified strongly with their Arab heritage as first and second generation, but they loved America. They were not alienated from America. They did not feel like they wanted to be, after World War II, they decide they want to be American, and they go, they most of them are, these Muslims are 100% committed to the American experiment, and they become people of the heartland. They hunt like everybody else. They participate in 4-H like everybody else. They love to go to the movies like everybody else. And, they can do both. They can be both Muslim and Midwesterners.
Interesting. So you mentioned growing up in Southern Illinois, it was a very Christian area. It felt like part of the Bible Belt. What was it like for you to discover more about Muslim communities in the Midwest?
Well, I writing the book was a very personal experience, and it changed my mind about my experience growing up in Mount Vernon in Southern Illinois. I certainly felt out of place in Southern Illinois. My color, my brown skin, was an issue. People asked me all the time, "What are you? What are you?" And what that meant was not what religion was I. It was what race am I? Because that's very important in a racialized society to be able to place you as black or white. They didn't think I was foreign because I didn't have a quote unquote foreign accent. So I had to be along that black-white continuum for people around whom I grew up. I felt like my presence there was a foreign intrusion into a land that was completely white. And what this story, I've always loved and identified with my Southern Illinois and my Midwestern roots, and I was raised to do so. I'm going to Giant City tomorrow, for example, before I make my way up to Springfield to give a talk at the Abraham Lincoln Library Museum, which is a sort of a dreamy thing for a boy from Southern Illinois, for who was taught that Lincoln was like a demigod. Okay, so I'm a Midwesterner, and I always felt out of place, connected, but not quite. Well, it turns out my story, the story of my family, is far more common than we're often taught, that somehow all of this immigration is new. No, it's not new. We've always been first, Native peoples were themselves diverse. And then when Afro-Eurasians arrived, we were always diverse by race, by ethnicity, and by religion. And it, writing this book, the experience of doing it made me renew my love of this region and my feeling that I am indeed a person of the heartland.
So we're running short on time here. What were some of the most surprising things you learned while writing and researching this book?
Well, I just to illustrated that, that Arabs aren't very foreign. I mean, people think, for example, I think if you ask people, how new is hummus? Everybody eats hummus now, chickpea dip with a little bit of sesame seed paste. I discovered in the 19 teens in the newspapers out in the Dakotas that they had introduced hamus, HAMUS, they called it hummus, as early as the 19 teens. They were farming chickpeas in the Dakotas and making dip out of it. So I love that story. I think that symbolizes the idea that we have a hidden history here that has just been waiting to be uncovered, of our being part and parcel of this place rather than being new to it.
And in the book is, I mean, you said you felt out of place coming up in Southern Illinois, but this book, it doesn't just focus on discrimination. There's also a lot of celebration as you're talking about hummus. Are there any other instances of that stand out to you want to mention?
Oh, I mean, I think Cedar Rapids stands out as probably the place where, of all the communities I cover, Syrian and Lebanese Muslims are most integrated into their communities. By the 1930s, they establish their own mosque in Cedar Rapids, and people, non-Muslims, regularly come to the mosque for, to perform,
They do all kinds of, it's like a community center, like any church or synagogue is in Cedar Rapids. And the Iowa Secretary of State comes to celebrate the third anniversary of the mosque in the 1930s. Now, this is a very public embrace. It's in the newspaper. It's a very public embrace by a high-ranking government official of Muslims in Iowa, in the nation's heartland. And that was deeply surprising. So there was, you know, there was, of course, there's loss, there's discrimination, there's also incredible success going on in terms of the participation of Muslims in the civic culture of the Midwest before World War II.
All right, the book is called Muslims of the Heartland, How Syrian Immigrants Made a Home in the American Midwest. If you happen to be in Springfield or you want to visit beautiful Springfield this Thursday evening, 7 p.m., April 7th, at the Union Theater, which is part of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, Edward Curtis will be giving a talk about his book. He's also a professor of religious studies and chair of liberal arts at IUPUI in Indianapolis. Edward Curtis, thank you so much for being with us and sharing your research with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you for inviting me.
And that is all the time we have for our show today. Before we go, I do want to urge you to visit our website. You can find more information about what we talked about, links to articles, links to events like the one we just mentioned. That's all on our website again at 21stshow.org, 21stshow.org. While you're there, you can also subscribe to our podcast. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and NPR One. The 21st is produced by Anna Casey, Aiden Choate, and Erica Scalise, who's also our engagement producer. Our interns are Owen Henderson, Zainab Qureshi, and Brielle Skullark. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.